Yo, what's up, everybody? It's another episode of Real Sankar Hours. Today is Sunday, October 22nd, 2023.
It's a very special episode.
Yeah, it's a very special one because this is the first time where Peter and I are recording in the same space. Like, he's literally right next to me.
Yeah. Yes. No more tricam. Well, we'll go back to that. But I happen to be in the Bay Area, and so this was always like a goal of ours. So
yeah,
we're alive. Well, not in the studio, we're just in Adam's living room.
Yeah
but
yeah, so we're just chilling. Yeah, it's another free episode of Real Sankar Hours, your favorite Black Marxist Pan-African socialist political podcast. Yeah, today's October 22nd. I'm Adam Hudson,
and this is Peter M. Gunn. And I mean, it is the timing. I almost want to say couldn't be better because it's horrible.
But, yeah.
for the topic, I think it's, I don't know, it feels somewhat significant to be doing it in person.
Yeah.
So.
And so just a little short housekeeping. If you want to stay up to date with Real Sankar Hours, go to realsankarhours.org. And if you like this episode, you want to listen to others, on our website, you'll see our Patreon and where to subscribe. $5 a month gets you bonus episodes. $3 a month does not get you bonus episodes, but it keeps the podcast afloat. Thank you to all of our patrons. RealSankarHours.org. And on that website, you can see where to follow us and how to subscribe and become a patron. And also a link to make a one-time contribution. We are a worker cooperative LLC, so we're not a nonprofit. So that means donations are not tax deductible, but you will be supporting independent Black media.
And independent media is very necessary.
Yeah.
In a time like this.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So, anyway, yeah, realsankarhours.org, that has all the stuff you need to, where you can find us on different platforms like Spotify, Patreon, et cetera, Instagram, all that fun stuff. But anyway, yeah, let's get into it. So like 2 weeks ago.
All right. Do you want to start off with Keefe D?
Yeah. So, so obviously like the events in, you know, Palestine, Gaza, that's going to probably make up the bulk of this episode. But, let's talk about Keefe D. So, obviously one of the greatest rappers who ever lived, Tupac Shakur, he was murdered in June of 1996. Peter and I were both young at that time, but
I didn't know who he was at the time.
But we were definitely like alive at the time. I don't know the age demographics of our audience, but I take it if you're like Gen Z if you're Gen Z, you probably weren't alive when that happened. But Tupac was killed in a drive-by shooting in Las Vegas and
on the strip, right?
Yeah, like
on the strip,
yeah, on the Las Vegas strip. And his murder was unsolved for almost 20 years up until recently. Like, so Keefe D, he was a gang member. He was in the car where that basically the car that did the drive-by, like what basically it was Suge Knight and Tupac Shakur in this BMW. Then a car pulled up beside them and someone pulled out a gun and started firing, and that's how Tupac was killed. And basically all the people in that car are dead except for Keefe D. He's the only like surviving witness in that car. So anyway, he got arrested for basically charged with basically being involved in the murder of Tupac Shakur. So, and that's pretty freaking big, I think. And I wanted to kind of touch base on that because, yeah, because that murder was like unsolved for almost 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it is almost without precedent. I mean, Tupac and Biggie, that like these worldwide celebrities were gunned down. Well, I guess not in broad daylight, but, you know, in public view. And the police are just like, "Oh, we got nothing." I mean, there are lots of reasons for that, you know, Las Vegas police and LAPD and the FBI. I mean, I suppose the hope is that we actually start to get some answers, because it's just there. The whole saga, especially towards the end of his career, is very much tied up with like COINTELPRO and the FBI, and yeah, and just I don't even know the interplay between the intelligence community and the music industry, I guess you could say. So I don't know how much they're gonna get out, or I mean, you know, I assume this is gonna be a trial, and so hopefully we're able to get some more answers.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if I said this nearly 20 years, but actually it's been nearly 30 years, because it happened in 1996.
Yeah, man.
I was like I just, yeah, it's so over.
That's
20 years.
That's how old we are.
Yeah. So, but Keefe D himself, I mean, he has a big ass mouth, because he was been doing a bunch of interviews where he like basically bragged about being involved in the murder of Tupac Shakur. Now, Keefe D was, I believe, he was a relative of Orlando Anderson, who I think is the alleged trigger puller, but he died a year after Tupac did. He was killed. So I think that like kind of set back the investigation, is that like one of the prime suspects was dead. But Keefe D and Orlando Anderson were related, and obviously were in the same car together, the one that, you know, drove up next to Tupac Shakur and killed him. But yeah, so he's been charged with murder. He has a murder charge, Keefe D. So
and we did an episode on Tupac a while back.
Yeah, we did.
Maybe. I can't remember if it's Patreon, but
yeah, we did. Yeah, we did a free episode. I think we did a bonus episode where we talked about the murder of Tupac Shakur. So that might be worth unlocking, because we recorded that a couple years ago. I think like 2.5 years ago or something.
Yeah, no, it was early 2021. Yeah, it had to have been.
Anyway, you guys can go back and listen to that if you're interested, especially if you're a patron. It's a bonus episode where we talk about the murder of Tupac Shakur. I think like one thing that I want to say about it is I think there's reason to believe that P. Diddy was involved in the murder, because in a lot of the interviews with Keefe D, he was basically hinting at that P. Diddy put out the hit on Tupac, and he and Orlando Anderson carried it out. So I wonder, I'd be curious to see, like, you know, if this goes to trial, if Keefe D is gonna like rat out P. Diddy. That remains to be seen, but I think P. Diddy had something to do with it, like in terms of putting out the hit, because I think he had a motive to do it in terms of the whole East,
and without getting too much into the sort of media spectacle that was like the quote unquote East Coast, West Coast beef or whatever.
Yeah.
It's, you know, on some level, without saying that there's like, you know, condemning evidence. I think probably both Puffy, he's always going to be Puffy to me, especially at the time. Puffy and Suge Knight were overseeing something that was like, I think they knew it might end in violence. I mean, there's enough to point to sort of at least Puffy's knowledge of the Tupac's first shooting in New York.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say, but like I said, it's very much tied up in, you know, sort of the quote, the Bloods versus Crips kind of, like I said, I see it as part of COINTELPRO, like the whole thing in a sense. You know, what that meant in the 90s, so, like I said, hopefully we get some answers from it, because it is this sort of, it's just crazy for someone who is, like, so famous that it's just like, yeah, nothing. But that's just, you know, how any young black man was treated and still is by the authorities.
Anyway, so with that out of the way, let's talk about, like, I mean, this was going to make up the bulk of this episode is what's going on in Israel Palestine. It was now called the Israel Hamas war. So,
which is, I mean, even that is like an Israeli, coined term to.
Yeah,
it's really more an assault. And possibly leading up to, you know, an assault with genocidal implications.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, maybe we should, because, you know, when we last recorded October 1st, I was still in Wyoming then, but I was about to hit the road for a few weeks. And so, yeah, it was October 7th and just, I remember, like, when I first sort of saw the reports, I was like, uh-oh, that's not good.
Yeah. Well, actually, like, well, let's, like, mention, like, what happened on October 7th. So, basically, Hamas fighters and Palestinian militants broke through the barrier in Gaza, because Gaza is basically, it's, you know, the world's largest open-air prison. And it's like 5 miles wide and like 26 miles long. So,
yeah, it's like 150 square miles.
Yeah. And so there's at the south, the south of Gaza borders Egypt. There's a Rafah crossing. So Egypt controls that and seals it off. And Israel controls like sea, air, the borders of Gaza. So Israel controls like what goes in and what goes out of Gaza. And it's not just like, oh, we need to prevent, guns and weapons from going to Gaza. Like they prevent like food, like chocolate and other things. So
building materials. It's like parts of Gaza never get rebuilt from the last time Israel destroyed it.
Yeah.
I honestly, even prison kind of almost implies level of criminality, and it is a concentration camp, and that phrase existed before the Holocaust. Concentration camps were pioneered like during the Boer War, I believe, is sort of the first modern documented use of them. And it's a classic colonial tactic of warehousing a population. I guess.
So Palestinians broke through. And that was unprecedented. Like, broke through the barrier of Gaza. And, sadly, I think over 1,000 Israeli civilians were killed. And like 200 hostages, 200 Israeli hostages were taken. Now, I know, like, Electronic Intifada, they did, there were some reports of, I think, friendly fire.
From
IDF killing Israeli civilians, but the death toll of Israelis was
higher than it's been in, I mean, almost in the entire history.
Yeah, of it's conflict. It was unprecedented. So I think that's what took people by surprise was one, the number of Israeli casualties, and two, the fact that like Hamas and Palestinian militants broke through, because Israel has this image of being like militarily invincible, and so it's like, wait a minute, how could like these people who are in a concentration camp basically succeed against like a much more sophisticated like military power in Israel?
And like more, even more astounding is that, you know, Israel prides itself on basically being like the laboratory for surveillance technology that it then sends or sells to, you know, any government around the world, you know, doesn't matter what their quote unquote human rights record is. Israel and Gaza is probably the most surveilled place on earth. And so, you know, this is the height of any sort of like surveillance, mass surveillance apparatus. And they just missed it. I mean, in some sense, and I want to be very clear about what I'm saying. There is a level of it being inspiring that, you know, and obviously not like the loss of civilian life. That's not what's inspiring. But the fact that, you know, the biggest, most complex high-tech surveillance state, like it can't stop humans determined to do something. Like, you know, the part of the timing of the attack, I think this is, it's obviously, it was obviously sort of strategically timed, because, you know, Israel was on the brink of, you know, or the United States was on the brink of overseeing you know, a peace deal normalizations between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states at large. And, you know, that's sort of, you know, and there, and obviously like the Gulf state governments don't really have any qualms selling out Palestinian people. And so, you know, it was, they like, you know, they needed, they kind of needed to stop that because, yeah, that would have been like a, just another nail in the coffin for any hope of an actual political solution, because the way it's presented and the, you know, most Westerners seem to have resigned themselves to the fact that, you know, the this occupation slash blockade could go on forever. I mean, it's based on the idea that the status quo was maintainable. You know, it doesn't matter the human suffering inflicted on Palestinians, that like that could go on basically forever. And you know, 3 weeks, 2 weeks later, that is obviously not the case. This is a very unfolding and unstable situation.
Yeah.
And nobody really understands the what's going to happen. I think, like, least of all, Israel itself. And, you know, how this ends, quote unquote, or if it ever ends, because none of these things ever end. I mean, you know, like, it flares up in the news for a while, you know, historically speaking, the all the ones, you know, we've witnessed flares up in the news for a while, and then, you know, some sort of ceasefire is reached, and then it goes out of the news, and everyone goes back to just pretending Palestinians don't really exist. And so that, you know, this is if only because of like the internal political situation inside Israel. They kind of can't. They are, you know, Netanyahu specifically, like, has no choice but to go all the way as he sees it. And the only people that can really stop them is America. So they don't really, you know, they have Joe Biden, who said if he were a Jew, he'd be a Zionist. And then it turns out he doesn't need to be a Jew to be a Zionist. He already is. there's literally a quote, a clip of him saying that like an AIPAC dinner. Yeah, he's pretty resolute in his support of whatever Israel is going to do. And that government now is filled with the most genocidal people they could find, who people for whom, like, even Israel was like, guys, that's, you're too far. But not anymore. And so they, it has been a very disorienting thing for me, just to sort of see, especially like fucking liberals.
So a few things. One, there were reports that Egyptian intelligence warned Netanyahu and the Israeli government that something big was going to happen. So, among some in the Israeli public have been criticizing the Israeli government basically for failing to protect Israeli civilians. So, which also kind of shows, like, puts a dent in, you know, Israel's image as not just this technologically sophisticated military power and like with this massive surveillance state, but also this Israeli intelligence being like shrewd.
They just didn't believe Hamas could do that.
Yeah. And so, I mean, so this is like kind of, ruining basically the image of Israel being invincible. And also like, you know, failing to like predict that this would happen. And also, Israel pulled, a lot of troops from its border with Gaza and put more of them in the West Bank, basically to, in service of, you know, Israeli settlers in the West Bank. So that was another part, was that Israel pulled back quite a few of its troops and put restationed them in the West Bank. So Israel wasn't protecting its border with Gaza as much as it typically would. Then there's also like the history of Hamas, because a lot of people, this doesn't get mentioned enough, is that Israel helped to create Hamas because in the 80s, because there was a split within Palestinian resistance between like the secular nationalists and then like the more, you know, militant,
the more religious faction.
Yeah, the more like kind of militant Islamic faction. And Israel basically, the strategy was to divide up the Palestinian resistance. So it supported Hamas to weaken, at the time it was called the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. Now it's the Palestinian Authority. But basically like the goal was to essentially divide up the Palestinian resistance and make it weaker. But now it's like blown up in Israel's face.
Yeah.
Its support of Hamas, which is actually like very similar to the U.S. playbook, which was to support like militant Islam to weaken as a hedge against basically to weaken essentially communists.
Yeah,
during the Cold War,
because the popular front for the liberation of Palestine was like a Marxist-Leninist organization. Which turned into the PLO. So that's kind of its roots, which is always hilarious. When, first of all, when Israel's like, oh, Hamas is so terrible, I'm like, well, that's your fault. But especially when and I saw this in the Atlantic and I was just like, god, then I clicked on the link and it was like this ghoul who like hadn't really written anything since like 2003 but brought up, you know, Hamas's founding documents, which was one of their favorite go-tos of, like, you know, there's some document where, like, it's our goal to kill all the Jews. I'm like, well, clearly that wasn't a sticking point for Israel when they were, like,
right, yeah,
promoting them. And they still like the idea of a divided Palestinian resistance. Like, you know, people found, like, Netanyahu saying that, like, recently, that they don't want them to be unified. And so, you know, and yeah, so it is a devil of their own making. And Israel does have carries the ultimate responsibility for what goes on, because they're the occupying power. We need to be very clear about that.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
There's this is, you know, an inevitable reaction to what you put when you're, like, Gaza is really, in a sense, like a laboratory, an experiment in, like, human cruelty.
Yeah.
It's impossible for either of us sitting here or you listening to it to truly understand what it's like to live there.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, to add on, I think, I'm not going to go through the entire history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but I do want to, like, kind of at least, like, give some historical context and, you know, like, for what it's worth, you know, like, my degree from Stanford is in international relations with a minor in Middle East studies in Arabic. And when I was a freelance reporter, like, a couple of years, like 10 years ago, I spent 3 weeks in Guantanamo reporting from there. And, like, I have a fairly long track record of writing about the U.S. war on terror and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So, like, there's, I think I might include some books that are useful for people to read to basically, like, to get more, a more solid historical footing in terms of understanding the roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because so for one, I'll talk about, like, how Hamas, like, got into power, and then I'll talk about, like, the actual historical roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So Hamas came into power, like, in 2005. So basically, Israel withdrew settlers from Gaza, and then elections were held, and the Palestinians elected Hamas, and Israel and the United States did not like that.
Even though they're the ones who pushed for elections.
Yeah, and so basically the blockade and the siege of Gaza was essentially punishment for Palestinians voting for, like, the people that Israel and the U.S. did not like.
And notably, they've not allowed any more elections in Palestine.
Right, yeah. And so, and Hamas, like, there's, like, two kind of wings of Hamas, to put it, like, very simply, because they do run social services in Gaza, and then there's an armed wing, like a militant wing, basically a paramilitary wing of Hamas. And they're the ones who do, like, the more, like, armed resistance, you know, of Hamas. And then Hamas also, like, does social services, but at the end of the day, they're not a governing, they're not like a governing body of a sovereign state. Israel remains occupying power, even though, like, it withdrew settlers, because of what Israel controls in Gaza. They remain the occupying power, even legally, in terms of international law. Israel is the occupying power in the Gaza Strip, even if it withdrew settlers, because of the degree to which Israel controls Gaza's sea, air, and the borders. So the degree of control that Israel has over the lives of people in Gaza makes it the occupying power. So that we want to make that like very clear, because that's important to understand that there is a power dynamic between Israel and the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So there's that. And also, by the way, since then, Israel has repeatedly bombed Gaza, like, repeatedly.
Usually when Netanyahu's poll numbers drop.
Or... Yeah, and so that also has to be made very clear, because, like, the reactions to this have been interesting. On the one hand, there's, like, the standard, like, liberal reaction, and then, like, I've been seeing more critique of Israel's actions, which, you know, having... I used to be involved in anti-war activism and Palestine solidarity activism in college at Stanford from, like, you know, 2006 to 2010. And I remember during that time, it was, like, criticizing Israel was still very taboo. Even though, like, I would talk with some of my fellow students and there'd be some who would critique Israel in terms of, like, hey, yeah, like, there is an Israel lobby, and is Israel's interests align with U.S. interests? So there'd be some, like, kind of critique, but to, like, openly stand up for Palestinians was very much taboo at the time, because that was still, like, in the shadow of the war on terror, and there was still this portrayal of Muslims as, like terrorist adjacent, or that, like, you know, there would be academics and journalists who would be like, well, you know, does Islam as a religion promote terrorism and blah blah blah, like that was, yeah, that was going on, talked about at that time, because of the shadow of, you know, 9/11 and the war on terror. So to see, like, more protests in solidarity with Palestinians around the world, this is this is fairly new. So which is, I'm glad to see it, but as someone who's, like, kind of been involved on these issues for a long time, like, this it wasn't always like this, and it was like I said, taboo to speak up for Palestinians for a long time. But I think, like, one thing that I've noticed, and in some ways it frustrates me, is that, like, there are a lot of people who act like that this event is basically like an isolated event, that it's not part of, like, a chain of events that led up to this. And there are a lot of people who are commenting on this who, like, honestly started paying attention to Israel-Palestine, like, last month rather than, like, years, you know, of, you know, and like, I understand, like, you know, everyone has a starting point in terms of, like, how they understand politics and world affairs and issues, but, like, you know, I don't really want to hear from, like, in terms of someone's opinion about Palestine, like, unless you're, you know, like, there's a lot of, like, uninformed,
yeah,
opinions on Israel Palestine.
Though honestly, I will say that, like, the people I save my strongest wrath for are not the, like, the because at least, you know, Americans aren't really, you can't really expect Americans to think about any part of the world.
Yeah, not true.
But
yeah,
the people, especially, like, columnists, people on TV, politicians, people whose job it is to write about this
stuff. Yes.
Who have been following this, and they've witnessed, you know, 2000, all the different operations. I mean, I, on a personal level, I think that I wasn't really aware of the reality until about 2010. And then I remember very distinctly, sort of, because it's actually basically what got me on Twitter, was Operation Pillar of Defense, the, like, 2012 campaign, because that was the first time, like, you know, people were tweeting from Gaza. And I remember it just kind of destroyed me. Like, it was for 4 or 5 days, all I could do was just refresh. And it's just like, because it was also the only way you could get, like, another version of, you know, because the media, I mean, even then, like, you know, would still just be like 4 Israelis killed in like 36 point font, and then like in 200 Palestinians in like 10 point font. And I was just like, yeah, it didn't even, you know, the media has like somewhat evolved, but at the same time, like the Israeli propaganda outlets have also evolved. And yeah, the initial reactions from people who really should know better, to just, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, you brought up like 2006 or, you know, that time period. And I felt like it was that again. I felt like I was back in 2003, when just everyone lost their fucking minds.
Yeah.
And yes, the concept that like, this is an ongoing, like there are, you know, and honestly, I didn't even realize, like, I remember I thought there were like 1.5 million people in Gaza. And so the population has actually grown a significant amount, despite, you know, just the most horrible circumstances you can think of. But yeah, the amount of people who are just like, who like, yeah, it's their job to follow politics, international politics, write about this stuff. They know, they just saw, you know, Israel. I mean, at this point, I feel pretty comfortable in saying that Israel is a fascist dictatorship. Like, I don't, like, Netanyahu is a dictator. So every liberal who thinks that standing up for Israel is like standing up for liberal democratic values, like, I don't know what the fuck you think you're doing anymore. Like, or just hand waving, like, you know, this is going to be, you know, both sides. We just lament the loss of life. Like, you know, the fact that Israel was shown to have some weakness, I mean, I think everyone knew that. It was like, I mean, the math is usually like a 10-to-1 type thing, 100-to-1. So if 1,000 Israelis died, that means that, like, the IDF won't really be satisfied until 100,000 Palestinians are dead. And honestly, that's probably how they're looking at it. You know, but there are many people, like the fact that they, you know, ordered the evacuation of half of Gaza, that they were, you know, calling openly, people in the government are openly calling Palestinian, like all of them, animals, shutting off, like these are, you know, every single person who's like, we need to combat the rise of authoritarianism and stand up for democracy, and, you know, and also we're all about, you know, Ukraine has a right to resist occupation and oppression, and you know, it's like, but, you know, that doesn't apply to Israel, when it's just like the most blatant it's ever been. That, like, what, like, what do you stand for? Like, what is the point? Like, why are you doing this with your, why are you alive? I almost want to say, like, in the sense of, like, what is the point of writing your stupid little column, where you're like, where your main issue is that, like, somebody on a college campus had a reaction you didn't like about it, and that's the real problem, and not that, like, you're gonna, like, these are all people who have essentially signed off on, like, you know, some people deserve to be genocided. Like, that is honestly, you know, there's the people who are just like, we want to genocide because we're fucking losers and wastes of humanity, and that's the only thing that makes us feel good is fantasizing and doing genocide. But, you know, those people exist. But the fact that there's still, like, this larger cover apparatus of, like, you know, well, let's weigh the facts, and, you know, people who are like, well, like, let's look at the evidence as to whether or not maybe Hamas blew up, Palestinians blew up their own hospital and not the country with a fucking air force. I mean, like, watching that kind of shit in real time, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to make it about me, but it is, like, there, it can make you crazy, except for the fact that, like, there are people out on the streets, which at least is, you know, a clear indication that, like, we're not the only, you know, you are not the only person who feels this way. Like, yeah, there's some, you know, there is like an actual Palestine solidarity movement in a way that there wasn't 10 years ago. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like about the, you know, the whole like, Hamas had bombed the Gaza hospital, not Israel. I mean, Israel's bombed hospitals in Gaza before. Like they bombed, Gaza's like only like I think COVID-19 clinic or something like that. Like Israel's repeatedly bombed Gaza like several times, and it's usually been like hundreds to a couple thousand Palestinians dead, and maybe like less than a dozen Israelis dead. The only difference now is that like you know, initially like yeah like nearly 1,000 Israelis were killed by Hamas, but at this point, as we speak on October 22nd, like there's you know. Over 1,000 Palestinians dead. Also, Gaza's population, half of them are children. So, you know, it was...
Who've never left Gaza.
Yeah, and also, like, Gaza, the territory, like, this is a refugee population. These are people who were expelled from their land in Palestine in 1948 during the Nakba to the Nakba, which is when, like, over 700,000 Palestinians were expelled from their lands to... when Israel was established. So you have those people and then their kids and their grandkids. That this is Gaza's population. Like this is basically a refugee population and the descendants of refugees. People who again were expelled from their land in 1948 during, you know, the Nakba to when the state of Israel was established. And so now like we're sadly, I think in terms of death toll, which is very morbid to even say and think about, in terms of the number of Palestinians being killed is, you know, more than the number of Israeli civilians being killed. And Palestinian children have been killed. Children have lost their parents. Parents have lost their kids. And basically, like, what's going on essentially is collective punishment that Israel is saying, like, okay, well, because Hamas was responsible, then, well, all of people in Gaza are responsible because, well, they elected Hamas. Well, here's the thing, you can apply that logic anywhere. Like, you could, like, that's the same logic that Osama bin Laden said, that, like, oh, Americans are responsible because, you know, they elected this, this, you know, imperialist government. And so, therefore, like, his logic was, okay, it's okay to, you know, is America civilians are fair game. And so, but that right there, again, that is collective punishment. Like, the actions of a few people gets used to justify like killing and punishing everybody else like within like that said group. So that's what's going on right now. And then, you know, millions of Palestinians, like thousands of Palestinians have been told by Israel that, you know, they have to leave Gaza. But it's like, where the fuck can they go? You know, it's like, oh, well, yeah, they could just go to Egypt. I'm like,
Egypt's not going to sign off on that.
Egypt's not going to, you know, they're not going to sign off on that. And so it's like, the people of Gaza have nowhere to go. And so as Israel just keeps bombing Gaza, like, it's like shooting fish in a barrel at this point. Like, that's what Israel is doing with the people of Gaza. And, you know, you know, and to be clear, like, the loss of Israeli civilians was incredibly sad. And, you know, like, their lives are worth just as much as Palestinian lives and anybody else. But again, like, this did not occur in a vacuum. And what I was going to say about, like, the, you know, historical roots of this, there's a really good book I read years ago by David Hirsch called The Gun and the Olive Branch. So I would highly recommend that everybody who's listening to this episode look up that book and get a copy of it, because it's a really good book. Basically, the point of the book was to look at the roots of the conflict in the Middle East and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And basically, his point was that, like, Arab violence in the Middle East is a response to aggression. And that goes back to, like, the 1880s. And so,
yeah, I mean, yeah, or I just want to say, like, the reason America supports Israel so much is because its strategic location to keep you know, the Middle East divided, like, to prevent any sort of, like, unified Arab nationalism from ever breaking out in that region. It's very useful for the empire in that sense.
Yeah, and so I mentioned I would, like, kind of briefly touch on, like, the historical roots of the conflict, but so essentially, like, Zionism as an ideology is distinct from Judaism as a religion and Jewish ethno-religious identity, right? So somebody could be Jewish ethnically and religiously, but not be Zionist in terms of their politics. And on the flip side, someone can be non-Jewish, but still be a Zionist in terms of the politics. Example, case in point, President Joe Biden. So Zionism as a political ideology emerged in, like, in the late 1800s by Theodor Herzl. And basically it was a response to the treatment that Jews were facing in Europe. For example, like the pogroms in Tsarist Russia. So the idea was like, okay, well, Jews need a state of their own. And so the question was, like, you know, where to put it. By the way, like, one of the places suggested would be somewhere in East Africa, like
Uganda. Madagascar was floated.
They yeah,
kind of like
yeah. So, but they were like, hey, let's put in the. At the time, it wasn't called Israel. At that time,
it was the British Mandate of Palestine.
Well, it was, the land was still called Palestine. This is before, actually, like, yeah, getting to the mandate, but this is, like, pre-British mandate Palestine. It was, the land was, I think, like, if you look at old maps, it was called, like, Palestine.
Under the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, exactly. So the Ottoman Empire controlled those lands for, like, I think nearly 1,000 years, something like that. And so World War One happens from 1914 to 1918. War breaks out. And the U.S. enters World War One in 1917. Is Britain, France, Russia against, like, Germany, Italy, and
Austria-Hungary.
Austria-Hungary. Yeah, my bad. Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire. So, at that time, because of technology was changing, so oil became more important for, you know, because this is, like, the beginning of, like, automobiles and using oil for planes and ships and stuff like that. Like, we're getting from the steam engine era into the era we're now in, where everything's powered by oil, natural gas, petroleum. And it was around that time that, like, you know, British sort of, like, geologists discovered, like, hey, wait a second, there's a shit ton of oil in Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East. Like, and it's untapped. Like, no one's getting dibs on it. We want dibs on this shit.
Yeah. back in the day, oil just would just seep out of the ground. And Aaron's like, yeah, that's old, that's gross black stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, so, why is World War One important? Well, there is this agreement called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And it was an agreement between Britain, France, and Russia to divide up the lands of the Middle East. So Britain would get modern day Israel, Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq. France got Lebanon and Syria. Russia, I think, was supposed to get, like, some, like, more northern part. But anyway, something happened in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution. And so the Bolsheviks found that agreement and were like, hey, wait a second, fuck this shit. Look at Tsarist Russia going along with these imperialists. So, but anyway, that didn't stop, like, Britain and France's plans, because once World War One ended, they League of Nations were established, and they use that to basically carve up their spheres of influence. And then there is also the Balfour Declaration, which basically signed on to basically Britain promising to support a homeland for the Jews in the British Mandate of Palestine. But here's the thing is that during the World War One, when Britain supported the Arabs who were rising up against the Ottoman Turks, and the Arabs were like, because this is at the time where nationalism was rising like worldwide. So the Arabs are like, hey, we want our own like independent nation for the Arab people. So it's like Britain was like sort of making contradictory deals. So the Arabs like
classic British Empire.
Yeah. And so the Arabs like, hey, wait a second. You promised us like a independent state. And like, wait, like they had an issue with it. And at the time, like, you know, in the late, like beginning of the like early 1900s, like there was increasing Jewish migration and settlement in the land of Palestine. And, that came into tension with the Arabs there. And so basically the whole idea of having a Jewish state would entailed having a Jewish majority state, but that conflicted with the reality on the ground, which was, well, the majority of the population are Arabs. Arabs of different religious identities, by the way. So not just Muslims, but also Christians, Arab Jews. So, but there are more European Jews moving to that area. And so that created a lot of tension. And so, anyway, so the Balfour Declaration is important to remember. So is the Sykes-Picot Agreement, because that laid the groundwork for all this shit that's happening right now. It's
why the Middle East is fucked up.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's similar to how the Europeans divided up Africa during the Berlin Conference of 1884, 1885.
Yeah, that's like why there's just like big old straight lines going through the Middle East.
Yeah. There's also another book I want to recommend. I read this book years ago, but it's a great book by Robert Baer. He was a former CIA operative, and the book is called Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he talks about like what I was saying about like the importance of oil, why it became so important for the British and the West. That book goes into that. So Sleeping with the Devil, Gun in the Olive Branch. So giving you guys two book recommendations to help understand like the roots of conflict in the Middle East. And then, okay, yeah, so 1948 happens. And like I said, that was a Nakba for Palestinians, because to make room for this new Jewish state, Israel, entailed basically kicking Palestinians out of their land. And then there's been like, you know, a series of wars. One of the most important is 1967 Six-Day War, where that's where Israel, they captured essentially the Golan Heights, the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and the Sinai Peninsula. But those lands, like Golan Heights, was given back to,
it's still occupied.
Yeah, still
occupied. Because they have birthright trips to the Golan Heights.
Yeah, but the Sinai was given back to
Egypt. Yeah,
yeah, back to Egypt. But the Six-Day War, like basically the aftermath of that was basically to establish the boundaries of like essentially like a two-state solution, that you'd have like a Palestinian state and a Jewish Israeli state, right? So the Palestinian state would have been like the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and then Israel would. But since then, like the reason why people say that the settlements in the West Bank are illegal is because they go beyond the 67 borders in the West Bank. So like the West Bank now looks like Swiss cheese, you know. So, and also those settlements, they get a lot of the important water too. So, and then there's like this series of checkpoints that Palestinians have to go through, and then violence from Israeli settlers. And so David Hurst's book is a good one, because he explains that the Arab violence wasn't from just like primordial anti-Semitism.
I love any book that talks about the mind of the Arab.
Right. Yeah. But he was saying like the. I mean, and he's right because it actually applies to what's going on today. Is that Arab violence is a response to aggression, and so I would also say like for the October 7th tragedy is that that's a result of essentially Israel's actions, the expulsion of Palestinians, the ongoing really ethnic cleansing and apartheid that Israel commits against Palestinians.
Yeah.
And Hamas, like, I mean, its roots are also in the Muslim Brotherhood. And like I said, like Israel, like supported Hamas to break up Palestinian resistance. But the thing is like, it's still operating from like some real Palestinian anger.
Yeah, I mean, it does have support. It's not.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's like this whole thing of like, well, it's not Hamas. You know, the people who are like, we support Palestine, but we condemn Hamas. It's like, well, that's silly. And that's making it about you. Because it's like that they are the resistance. And, you know, especially like the Palestinian Authority. You know, many people, I'm not going to say it, but many people view them as collaborators with Israel at this point. And Hamas is the only one who militantly resists Israel. And so, you know, when your life is like, it's important to remember in Gaza, it's like 50%, there are no jobs.
Yeah.
There's no economy really to speak of.
Yeah, no.
And so, in many ways, like, you know, I'm trying to remember who said it, but yeah, like the idea, like in many ways, being a martyr is like, if you're a young man, especially, like that is sort of the best thing you can do with your life. That's like your goal.
Yeah.
Is to martyr yourself, because that is basically the only thing you have to give is your life, because there's, like I said, there's no opportunity for economic advancement. There's no jobs. Like, you can't leave to go and get educated somewhere else, really. And you can't even move to the, you can't go to the West Bank. Like, you know, Israel wants the land in the West Bank. For their like, if you actually see an Israeli settlement, it looks like, to kind of give you, you know, like, the people probably have in their mind sort of what, like, you know, an Arab city looks like from some terrible movie made in the 2000s that's like, you know, bleak, poured concrete and just like, you know, it doesn't, but like Israeli settlements look like just the most aggressive, like suburbia, like they've got the lawns and like McMansions, and you know, it is essentially like suburbia next to, you know, abject human misery, like, you know, and it's important to try and like keep that kind of image in your head of what the occupation is. But Gaza, like, Israel doesn't have a use for it. It's not even colonialism in the sense, like, they're just warehousing people because they haven't figured out what to do with them yet. And, you know, some people in the IDF have some ideas about what to do with them. And, you know, what they're doing now is seeing if America is going to let them get away with it. And so, you know, it really actually does matter that we in America speak out about this call, just tell the fucking truth and show up, because, you know, even though almost every single member of Congress is bought off by AIPAC, and, you know, all the state, how many fucking state legislatures have, like, passed resolutions so that you know that, like, North Dakota stands with Israel, and criminalizes BDS and outlaws BDS, you know. Hilarious from where all the fucking free speech people when it comes to this issue.
Really?
You don't fucking hear any of them. Any free speech absolutist has nothing to say about the fact that they're criminalizing a political movement. They are criminalizing speech. They're always saying you're not allowed to say this. You know, people are getting doxxed and trying to get people fired for going to Palestine demonstrations. So, you know, there is some risk involved, but it is necessary. Like, I don't, you know, it has, there's, it means something to see that people are out there and that, like, not everyone is falling for this, you know, that not everyone is okay with this. And that's also true inside Israel. I mean,
yeah,
there are, and, you know, many, I mean, on it, though, honestly, I believe that, like, anyone who grows up in Israel who has a shred of sense, like, does not stay there. But, you know, it's complicated. But, you know, many people in Israel don't like what's going on. They're not stupid. And they think, you know, they understand the situation. And, you know, I don't know why they can't do anything about it politically. But all because, you know, for the same reasons, you know, what is the Israeli left? I mean, it's as ineffectual as the American left. Though, I mean, yeah, labor Zion, you know, the Israeli left still is, like, part of the settler colonial project. But, like, I'm just saying that many people in Israel don't support this, don't support what's going on.
Yeah, know? Like, journalist Gideon Levy and Amira Haas are two cases in point. Like, they wrote some very scathing articles critical of Israel after October 7th. And, like, you know, and also there are a lot of Jews in the diaspora, particularly Jewish Americans, who, like, I think Jewish Voice for Peace, and there are a lot of Jewish like organizations and like civic organizations who've spoken against, you know, loss of life, and also been very critical of Israel and the occupation. And so I think that's important to reiterate the distinction between Israel's actions, the actions of the Israeli government and the Israeli apartheid settler colonial system, and the ideology of, like, you know, the Israeli far right and far right Zionism, distinguishing that from Jews as a community, the Jewish community, Jews as a people, and Judaism as a religion. I'm not super religious myself, but I find it hard to believe that, like, you know, the Old Testament would call for, like, ethnically cleansing Palestinians. I don't know if there's a passage there.
I don't know. I don't know what the.
But it's, I mean, because it's like, I have an issue just in terms of, you know, anybody using their religion to justify, like, you know, injustice, particularly, like, you know, white supremacy and imperialism and ethnic cleansing, using your religion to justify that. So, like, I think it's important to distinguish, like I said, Jews as a community and as a people, and Judaism as a religion, and the ethnic religious identity of Jewishness from Israel, the Israeli government, the Israeli settler colonial apartheid state. Like, which is to say that, like, criticizing Israel is not akin to anti-Semitism.
No.
Even though, like, there are a lot of Israel's supporters will argue that.
Yeah, Well, yeah, Israel wants people to think that they speak for all Jewish people. But, yeah, I mean, many, you know, if you pay halfway attention to it, it's just like, no. And especially, I think, especially in the past few years, as, you know, the Israeli government has just gone more and more right wing and more openly advocating for genocide, that I think a lot more Jewish people are like, no, I don't put me in this. Like, they don't. I think, you know, yeah, I think that, like, you know, the birthright trip or whatever, that doesn't, like, work anymore.
Yeah.
You know? Because you can only, you can't really cover up what you're doing when you also want the world to know that you're doing it.
And, yeah.
It's, yeah, there's just that. That's what's so interesting. I don't say interesting, but that's what's important about this moment, I think, is that all of the liberal bromides, I think, are pretty much out the window, and sort of the liberal superstructure that has honestly been most effective in, like, maintaining the political viability of the occupation, is, you know, it's, you can't, on the one hand, you know, say you care about peace and human rights and dignity for all, and then do anything other than, like, demand that Israel not do what it's very clearly signaled it intends to do. If you are someone who, like, sits on the sideline, or if you're making excuses, like, you're making excuses for a genocide, like, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's like, I mean, yeah, like, I don't feel any compunction about using that word to describe, you know, what the intent is, because Israel doesn't have many other options, honestly, like the corner they've kind of backed themselves into. But that said, I mean, there's no guarantee that they can actually pull it off, especially because, you know, there are other actors involved, like Hezbollah, who, you know, if they get involved, that really makes things, life not good for Israel.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, Hamas, like, they can fight. And it's not, you know, ground operations in the IDF don't always go as well as the IDF would like you to think that they do. It's very easy to blow up mosques and hospitals with the brand new fighter jets you just got from America. But when you actually have to fight people man to man, it's a little bit harder for, you know, the 19-year-old conscripts that, like, you know, really just want to be backpacking in, you know, Southeast Asia or whatever, but they got to do their, you know, they don't want to do this. I mean, every, like, Israeli, they don't want to, like, be in the military.
Yeah, and they're drafted too.
Yeah, yeah, right. No, every man and woman has to, every man has to do 3 years. I mean, and every woman has to do 2 years. And, you know, a lot of them, like, you know, I mean, a lot of what they do, like, if you get sent to Gaza or the West Bank, like, you know, you're doing war crimes, like,
yeah.
You know, and then you have to go be in a K-hole at a Berlin rave for 3 years or something. But
and also, like, you know, just recently, like, Israel launched strikes, not just in Gaza, but also
in the West Bank. I don't know how Hamas got there.
But. And Syria, too. So I think, you know, as, like, this is just going to get bloodier and bloodier. And that's what's so disheartening to watch is, you know, you have a defenseless population in Gaza, and it's just like I said, Israel's just basically shooting fish in a barrel at this point. And I do think, yeah, like, the intent of Israel, particularly under the Netanyahu government, is basically ethnic cleansing. Like, their solution to the quote unquote Palestinian problem is to just get rid of Palestinians, and to just, like, their final goal, which is to make, like, essentially, like, a full on Jewish ethno state. A state with majority Jewish population and rights for Jews and Jews only. And there are Palestinians in Israel, but they have less rights than Jewish Israelis. So, and there are also, like, black Israelis, like, particularly Ethiopian Jews, and there's racism against them in Israel. So there is a hierarchy within Israel among people who are Israeli, like, the people who are white Jews at the top, and then if you're, like, you know, brown or black Jew, you're at the bottom. And then obviously if you're Palestinian in the occupied territories, like, oh, like, you know, they're like, they pull a Palestinians basically to Israel pose quote unquote a demographic problem that there's just too many Palestinians to have this like single Jewish ethnostate.
Yeah. You cannot have a secular, democratic, Jewish majority state in that area that also has equal rights for everyone in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just can't.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think like with Israel now, particularly under Netanyahu, they're just like, you know what, let's just like go along with it. Like, fuck it. Just basically get rid of Palestinians. And so I think like that's what Israel's goal is in Gaza. And I think right now it's like Israel just doesn't give a shit about what the rest of the world thinks, because like Colombia, they're like, hey, whoa, like we're going to break off ties with Israel because of what you're doing. Like, so a lot of other countries have spoken out against Israel, but you know, as long as the United States keeps backing Israel and giving Israel $3 billion in military aid every year, Israel like can kind of do what it wants. And the U.S. like has kind of been like, yeah, Israel, do whatever you want, but hey, you might want to chill out a bit, but we're still going to support you.
You got to sell it to the liberals.
You know, so, and there's been some dissension within the Biden administration. Like, there was some guy within the State Department who resigned because he was like, yo, this is fucked up. Like, this is going too far. But I think, you know, as events unfold, I kind of think that there might be something akin to like World War III, because I think, you know, like I think at the very least Hezbollah is going to get drawn in.
And if they get drawn, you know, if Israel's like, if they, the thing is like, if Israel perceives that like this is it, then they'll start lashing out at Iran.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if they get involved in Syria, like Russia is still in Syria, and like, you know, then if that happens, then, you know, maybe Ukraine starts to bleed over, and then like, yeah, now we are officially in World War III. You know, Israel's got nukes. I don't think there's any reason to think that they would have any moral compulsion against using them. You know, like, it really comes down to what America is willing to tolerate. So it is like, America is the only country Israel will listen to.
Yeah.
We do have a duty in the United States to not be quiet about this. As much hell as we can, because if there are, you know, if somehow we're able to be political consequences in America for going along with this, like that might actually change people's calculations. But right now, most people in the government don't see there are political there are great political consequences for not doing everything Israel wants. I mean, you know, there's much more consequences for not blindly supporting Israel than there are for supporting Israel carrying out, you know, probably what would most like, oh, I was going to say the greatest war crime of the 21st century. I'm like, I don't know if Iraq is, yep, if it would, yeah, top Iraq, but it's the thing that everyone says that like we have human rights in the UN to prevent it from happening. So that's, if it, you know, you, the thing that everyone who is like, you know, where were you when it happened? You know, this is it. Like, this is it. Like, yeah, so it BDS is still important. It's still important to support Palestinians economically too. Don't be annoying about it, I guess. Don't be there definitely are some people who get a little too far, and it's just like, chill out, because it's not about you. I mean, unless you are Palestinian, right? Then it is about you. Random white college leftists, they don't like, yeah, there are people who probably, like, I would have an internal criticism for them to be like, that's probably not the right way to react in the immediate aftermath. But, you know, at the same time, like I said, the people who their main, you know, the real tragedy was that there were some annoying leftists on annoying people on college campuses, you know, saying long live the Intifada or whatever. Those people are like way categorically worse than any annoying college leftist. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's my caveat or whatever, but like, yeah, I mean, there is a Palestine solidarity movement. You know, there are if you are in a place where demonstrations are happening, you can make them. Please go out, you know. Try to, yeah, I mean, honestly, like, yeah, until the left gets serious and can actually take power, like, in some ways, that would be, honestly, like, one of the few new developments in the conflict that could actually change things, so... We do have to organize, like, if we are serious about this, we have to figure out how to organize around it and not through the Democratic Party, to be very clear. That's, you know, there's, yeah, it's pretty bought off, but,
yeah, I think, yeah, we can probably just, like, kind of end, I'll say, like, yeah, that'll be, like, kind of, like, a good way to end in terms of, like, what the people in the U.S. should do, and, yeah, pretty much echo what everything Peter said. I think what I would add is, you know, one thing I noticed, I think, some of the responses to, well, like the liberal responses to this, I think do reveal like an element of racism, because I do think that, I think like a lot of people in the West don't see Palestinians as humans. And but like when Israelis die, like they see as Israelis as people, and so those deaths hit harder than the deaths of Palestinians. And so like when Palestinians die, it's just like considered, you know, normal and like, you know, part of like, yeah, like how things,
yeah,
are
Palestinians, yeah, that's what they do,
yeah. And so but you know, yeah, there is like a rising global Palestine solidarity movement, and there's something worth building off of that, along with the solidarity between Black American activists and Palestinian activists, particularly after Ferguson, and then the last wave of Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. I think though that kind of solidarity building between different oppressed communities throughout the world is also something worth building on, to challenge the status quo, because you know, like we can make each other stronger against these forces that oppress us, and understanding the also very real linkages between the systemic racism here in the United States, particularly as perpetuated by the police and the prison system, between that and the Israeli apartheid state, particularly like how, you know, U.S. police like get training from Israel. So, so they share tactics in terms of how to suppress communities that they wish to keep basically in line. And so I think that kind of bridge building and solidarity between Black people and Palestinians is, I think, incredibly crucial and also very heartwarming to see and worth building on. And I definitely think this podcast, like, we certainly stand in that spirit in terms of like our activism and our political views. So yeah, and I think, yeah, with the state of the U.S. left, I think the only hope I see is the strength of labor unions, and I think having labor unions, you know, stand in solidarity with Palestinians, I think would also be really, yeah. I think that would go a long way, using the power of labor to challenge militarism. And I also, you know, I wish there was an actual, like, strong anti-war left in the U.S. Because I think having, like, an actual, like, anti-war left would, like, that would, I think that'd, like, be one of the main things to challenge, like, not just America's relationship with Israel, but, like, the American, like, permanent war machine.
Yeah.
That, like, that machine supports Israel. So, yeah, I think those are some things I have off the top of my head in terms of what should be done. And, you know, obviously, if there's demonstrations, like, try to attend them. If not, like, I think what's also important is just keep educating people, because I do think that Israel's propaganda, I think, is having less of an effect, which is a good thing, but there's still, like, a lot of people who are very much brainwashed, and so the more we have, you know, these types of discussions and education, I think it's crucial, especially just to say the radical thing that, like, Palestinians are human, which I think there's still a lot of people.
I mean, and people can say it, but they don't believe it. And I actually want to read something in that vein. This is from Robert Wright, who he's like a foreign policy guy. He has a newsletter that I subscribe to that I don't really read, but I read this one, and he had a paragraph that really stuck out to me. Because he's basically talking about how Israel and the U.S. have a strategic lack of empathy, and that's like why the situation is the way it is, because they refuse to acknowledge, like, so I'll just say this, how there can't, you know, the second question I posed at the outset of this piece, how there came to be so much discontent in the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinian resistance movements would coalesce and assume violent form. But the basic idea is just that the U.S. and Israel have repeatedly failed to give due consideration to how the world looks to oppressed and disenfranchised people who have the normal human allotment of pride, the normal human demand for respect, the normal human capacity for righteous indignation, and the normal human reflex of retribution. Then he says in parentheses, a reflex currently being demonstrated by Israel. And I think that's really kind of gets at the heart of it, is that, like, they are humans, and Palestinians are reacting as any human would react to the conditions they're in. And the fact that, you know, in many ways, and like I said, I'm very intentional with what I'm saying, so please don't misconstrue it. Like, the continue, you know, it's like I said, they want you to think the ruling class ideology and sort of the simulation version of reality is just that Israel is going to maintain this occupation forever. And, you know, Palestinians are just expected to eat shit. And, you know, if they're perfect victims enough, then, you know, maybe some Western liberals will get it. They'll get enough sympathy from Western liberals. That's, I don't know what they think that's going to do, but okay. But that's not what they're doing. You know, they continue to resist. They will always continue to resist. And it truly is, in my mind, one of the most beautiful reflections and expressions of the human spirit, is the Palestinian resistance. I mean, and it's not like they wanted it to be that way. But, you know, they are just fighting for a normal, dignified life, but they are fighting, you know, the entire world. They're not the entire world, but, you know, the biggest empire imaginable. It is, you know, and they continue to fight, and they'll never stop. And, you know, that, as I've been sort of in kind of a weird place mentally, kind of wandering, I guess, you know, thinking about that is like, that is, like I said, that is the human spirit in its truest form, is the Palestinian resistance. And so that is humanity. Like, it's that's important to understand. I mean, that's my opinion, but there, you know, it proves that the world does not have to stay the way that it is, and it can't. And that's important to remember. So I think that's probably all I gotta say.
Yeah, I think we can end on that note. So yeah, if you like this episode, again, $5 a month at patreon.com/realsoundcarhours. You'll get access to bonus episodes and keep this podcast afloat. And yeah, realsoundcarhours.org. That's you can see everything, follow us like on whatever platform play. So anyway, yeah, that's it for this episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. Keep the faith.
Stay dangerous. Free Palestine.
All right, free Palestine. Take care, everybody.